This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me E.J. Dionne, the columnist for The Washington Post and frequent guest you may have seen on MSNBC or listened to on NPR or seen on Meet the Press. His latest book is called Our Divided Political Heart. And if you're interested in U.S. history or if you're interested in political philosophy, if you're concerned especially about where we are right now in the U.S., it's a book you really should pick up. It's a great book. E.J. Dionne, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much. Thanks for those kind words.
Well, I mean it. I just was reading your book this morning. I tend to devour books like this in a gulp, and I enjoyed it and was stimulated by it. The subtitle of the book is The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. What is the American idea, and to what extent can it be said that we have an American idea or the American idea?
It's good that you asked that question, because when I was thinking about the subtitle, there is a great debate, and there has been for a long time, over whether there is such a thing as the American idea. And I decided that there is, and my definition of it has to do with the tension that I see running through us, running through our political history from the very beginning. It's a tension between our love of individualism, our emphasis on liberty, and our affection for community and our belief, I think, it's the dominant belief, even if our Tea Party friends don't think so, that the preservation of liberty is actually a common enterprise. And I've enjoyed sort of talking about the book because I like to point out to people that the very first word of our Constitution is the word we, as in we the people of the United States. And the goals described in the preamble of the Constitution are collective goals, common goals, including, by the way, general welfare. It's fun to note that welfare is in the Constitution mm-hmm. of the United States right at the beginning. And so I think that this kind of tension is a healthy tension. When we keep liberty and community, or liberty and the common good, in balance, we tend to succeed as a nation. And when we get them out of balance, we tend to have some trouble.
Speaking with E.J. Dionne about his latest book, Our Divided Political Heart, and you write in your introduction that you are writing with a sense of urgency, and I noted the word again appears on page 242, that, you know, this is an urgent thing that we've got to wrestle with right now. What is that urgency?
Well, I think the urgency comes from the fact that we have in our politics right now a form of conservatism that I see as more radical and quite different from the conservatism that most of us have lived with during our lifetimes. I mean, I'm a progressive, so I didn't vote for conservative candidates all those years. But conservatism over most of my life did include a strong sense of community. The conservative philosophy from the very beginning, in some ways, was a rebellion against a certain kind of liberal individualism. And, you know, it's worth remembering that William F. Buckley Jr.'s, one of his very last books, was a book called Gratitude, where Buckley emphasized the debts we owe for growing up in a society that nurtured us and protected us. I think now you've had conservatism taken over by what I call a radical individualism. And I think that's very different from the tempered American individualism. And I think that the Tea Party and their allies, and it extends beyond the formal confines of the Tea Party on the right these days, they really look to the Gilded Age, the period from 1865 to, we'll say, the ascension of Teddy Roosevelt to the White House, as the typical period of American history. That's who we are. I view that as an exceptional period in American history. And so I think that, you know, the talk that conservatives want to go back to the Gilded Age, I don't think that's just political talk. I think that is kind of analytically true, given what they believe, what courts were doing during the Gilded Age, and what politicians were saying during the Gilded Age.
I mean, it's such a weird thing because, of course, the Gilded Age of the robber barons, and now we have the Tea Party and the Republic, the basic element of the Republican Party right now, being apologists for big business, unapologetic apologists for big business, at a time when people were just ripped off by Wall Street. And so it's just striking to me how they can sustain that kind of argument that we need to just leave the playing field empty of any force that can regulate industry after industry unregulated, pretty much the financial industry destroyed the economy.
Didn't you mean job creators when you said big business? I mean, it really is interesting that I think you've had an offensive on behalf of business going on since the beginning of the Reagan era, and an attempt to reverse the assumptions that we've had pretty well since the New Deal, where the country, especially in the wake of the Great Depression, could believe no longer that the interests of big business utterly coincided with the public interest.
I mean, it's funny you mention Reagan, because Reagan said famously, government isn't the solution, government is the problem. And then in your book, you talk about Rick Perry saying he wants to make government as inconsequential in your lives as possible, which seems to be the Republican mantra right now.
Right. And I argue in the book that the current version of conservatism and republicanism is actually to the right of where Reagan ended up and to the right of where even George W. Bush was, because Reagan talked a very good anti-government game. But when it came down to it, partly because of the way political forces were arrayed in the country and partly because I thought there was still always a part of him that never fully forgot he had once been for FDR, he may have talked about dismantling Social Security when he was on the speaking circuit in the 50s, but he actually raised taxes to save Social Security. And now you have conservatism whose almost entire program consists of cutting taxes and deregulating industry. And that is the emphasis. And you know, Mitt Romney, whose history, certainly his dad, was a rather progressive Republican, and Romney in his as governor of Massachusetts, partly because he was constrained by Democratic Massachusetts, was not this far to the right. But ever since he entered the national scene in 2007, he's been moving that way. And his campaign rhetoric is very much this: unleash the job creators, cut taxes, get government out of here. And as I say, I think this is very inconsistent with a long American tradition, because we have always been a country that believed in countervailing power. We believe that the state should be limited, and this is true on the left as well as the right. The left, after all, includes people who are among the most passionate civil libertarians in the country. But so we want limits on government power, but we've also thought that government often needed to be called in to put limits on concentrated private power. And these days you say that sounds radical. This is not a radical view in American history. I went back and looked at some of the speeches Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson gave, and they sounded like they had just walked out of Occupy encampments. You know, it was really quite remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, one of the quotes is about speculators and financiers. That was a terrific one from
Right, and I think Wilson said at one point, I've got the book here, but I won't waste time looking it up, that you know, we are at a point where the power of high finance will be greater than the power of government. And Woodrow Wilson was no radical. But he was conservative in many ways. But there was a sense in the country that certain economic interests had become too powerful for the good of capitalism, let alone for the good of, you know, for the good of social justice or the common good.
Yeah, I think he said that presidents and elected officials would have to tip their hats to financiers, and that reminded me of how Jamie Dimon was received at the Senate.
That's no
recently.
Kidding. That was really...
So that seems to be, as you say, very contemporary. But this idea, so you trace this idea of government as a liberating force. You talk about H.W. Bush with the ADA, for instance, as using government as a liberating force. But you trace it all the way back to the founders. And I think that's an interesting exploration. You go all the way back. And I thought you were going to say Jefferson when I started. And then you go to Hamilton, which struck me as a little surprising. But why don't you make that case?
Sure. One of my favorite findings in this book from the reading I did, this actually is from a great book, by the way, for if I can plug somebody else's book, Brian Bailaw's book, historian at the University of Virginia, book Government Out of Sight. When was the first federal health care plan passed? It was actually passed in 1798, signed by John Adams, not a radical president, and it was establishing health care all around the country for sick and injured seamen. Now, I don't know what the power of the seamen's lobby was, but we had socialized medicine for seamen in 1798, and I do not recall mass protests against Adams care. The Hamilton, the whole Hamilton-Jefferson fight has been a subject for a lot of sort of thinking, commentary, speculation on the part of progressives for a long time, because progressives, you know, beginning with the populace, really, and one of the things I do in the book is I admire but disagree with Richard Hofstadter in his view of the populace. I think the populace were not an irrational movement. They were a deeply democratic movement. But one of the things they discovered is that given the power of concentrated wealth, government needed to play a larger role than a Jeffersonian would traditionally want to play. And so it came to pass that Herbert Croly, one of the sort of early theorists of American progressivism, talked about using Hamiltonian means to Jeffersonian ends, that Hamilton saw that the federal government could play a very constructive role in American life. The problem with the Federalists is that they had an elitist tilt. The Jeffersonians were more small-d democratic, but their view of government was very cramped. And so I do have a positive view of Hamilton and Clay and Lincoln for how they foresaw that without government, we would not build ourselves up into a great nation. We would not develop our economy the way we hoped. It was Hamilton who foresaw us as a major manufacturing nation. Henry Clay called his program the American system. And what's intriguing about that is he used the word American system to distinguish it from the British system, which he said was pure laissez-faire. So he saw America standing for something that was the opposite of traditional laissez-faire, which I suspect the Club for Growth wouldn't like very much these days.
E.J. Dionne, you mentioned the populist movement as being deeply democratic. This is along the lines of some revisionist progressive historians, Lawrence Goodwin, chief among them, but there are others too. Because Hofstadter, when I studied him in college, derided the populace as bigots, anti-Semites, reactionaries.
Right. It was a painful thing for me because I hugely admire Richard Hofstadter, and I pray that I could write as well as he can and also have the insights, because even when he's wrong, he's brilliant and insightful. So I write with great respect for Hofstadter, but I think Hofstadter, like a lot of a certain style of liberal writer and writers, historians, sociologists in the 50s, was reacting very much against both Stalinism and Nazism. And so that generation of liberals had a real mistrust of mass movements, especially populist-looking mass movements. They saw the Nazis as a kind of populist mass movement. So they looked back and picked out the least attractive parts of the populace. And look, there was racism there, but if you're going to say that of the populace, you had to say that about almost all the parties of that time. The Democrats, when they were the conservative party, were by far more racist. The Republicans, having been the anti-racist party, were kind of moving in that direction too. The anti-Semitism, there was some anti-Semitism there, but again, there was anti-Semitism in the society. There were other forces in the populist movement that were not at all anti-Semitic. Some actually, in its early days, the populists tried to create biracial alliances in the South to unite blacks and whites who weren't well off. And, you know, partly because the Bourbons sometimes tried to use African-Americans as a check on the populists. There came to be some real friction in that period. Charles Postel, a recent sympathetic historian of the populists, noted that they were known at the time as a reading and a writing party. They really spread mass education through the country. They set up reading groups in rural America. They set up lots of publications so that, I view the populists broadly as representing the sort of democratic commonwealth tradition, something that Goodwin writes about, something Harry Boyd's written about. And I think that Commonwealth tradition is also very much part of our history. And that's how I read the populace.
Speaking with E.J. Dionne, I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. E.J. Dionne's latest book is Our Divided Political Heart. This idea of the Commonwealth also was part of the progressive movement that the Progressive Magazine came out of. Robert La Follette was the founder, and you mentioned La Follette in here. You talk about there are different progressive colorations. You know, they're the elitist progressives who just wanted to be good government tinkerers from the upper class. But La Follette was of a different stripe. I mean, he was a radical democratic progressive, along with Jane Addams and others here, even more than Jane Addams, probably. And it's very interesting because he had fights with Teddy Roosevelt along the way, too. But he certainly was in this idea that we need to work together using the powers of the government to restrain corporate power. That was this huge battle of his life, the huge issue of his life. It's the issue a lot of us are dealing with today. And certainly that's the crazy thing about the Tea Partiers and also, you know, the Hayek conservatism, Ron Paul economic policy. They act as if you could just get government out of the way, everyone would be free. And they act as though they can't identify, you know, a huge Walmart in their neighborhood.
Right. No, it's and it is a real debate over what does it take to make people free. And again, I go back to the theme of the book, which is that, you know, liberty, yes, involves freedom from undue coercion by the state. That's absolutely right. And on some things I agree with my libertarian friends. But freedom can also be impinged by monopoly. Freedom can also be impinged by employers who abuse the power they have because people need the jobs. That's why we have unions and we need unions. And I think the progressives were struggling with how do you, you know, how can you use the power of the state to achieve a certain kind of liberation for the individual without abusing the power of the state. One of the things I write about a little bit in the book is one of the things I love about the progressives is what they did during the 1920s. If we think of the 1920s as a period of reaction, and in some ways it certainly was, and Coolidge was president before him, Harding, and yet the populists were there at moments they were the dominant group in Congress, and we forget how much of the legislation that saw the light of day under the New Deal was pushed for by the progressives in Congress in the 1920s, people like La Follette, like Fiorello LaGuardia, like Bronson Cutting out of Nevada, or George Norris. By the way, I have an attack on any liberal ever using the term flyover country. It really bugs me when liberals behave.
Well, tell me about it.
Because flyover country has been the heart of the American progressive movement. I'm not just pandering to Madison, where I happen to be sitting right now. It's in there in the book. But that's
we hate flyover.
Yes, no,
everyone in the Midwest hates it. I mean, it's so condescending.
Right, and I think that no progressive should ever use that term. It's appalling. But you look at those 20s progressives. And they just kept banging away, and they would suffer defeats. But the beautiful thing about democracy is no victory is final, no defeat is final. And they kept at it. And when the time was ripe, when the Depression began changing the country's mind, when Roosevelt himself was searching around for a program, there were these ideas. Some progressive state governments started, and I think Wisconsin was one of them, started trying to establish systems of Social Security so that you know, when progressives get low, when they have suffered periods of defeat, I think they should repair a little bit to those folks in the 1920s who didn't give up and who eventually changed the country, because many of the things they were talking about in the 20s are still part of our lives today.
You know, minimum wage, workers' comp, Social Security,
right.
All those things, unemployment insurance. So. And then you get to the New Deal, and your argument is that the New Deal is – still with us, and I certainly agree with that. I think this reactionary movement that is so much with us today is in response to the New Deal. They want to repeal the New Deal. They want to repeal the Great Society, which followed through on the New Deal. But it's amazing to me after, 70 years, 75 years, 80 years, the New Deal is still caught in their throat.
Right. And in fact, some of there's a great historian, Kim Phillips Fine, who has written a great book about how many of the ideas of the contemporary right weren't just created in the 70s. There's a standard trope, a standard, you know, and there's something to it that the new conservative movement really got going in the 70s with the neocons and the like. Where she notes that a lot of these ideas went back to the opposition to Roosevelt, went back to the Liberty League. And that Hayek, after all, wrote in 1943, and his book became a bestseller partly because a group of shrewd American businessmen bought a lot of copies and made it a bestseller, The Road to Serfdom. Indeed, and then this led to a sort of some of the ideas of the far right in the 50s. I think one of the disturbing things about the Tea Party, and I don't like to sort of tar whole groups of people. There are a lot of rank-and-file Tea Partiers who are simply opponents of high taxes, and I get that. But when you listen to Glenn Beck and others who really were important to the Tea Party in the early stages, A lot of the folks they're pushing were old John Birch Society writers, a guy called Skousen, who wrote a sexy-sounding book. I think it was called The Naked Communist. And, you know, so that these ideas on the far right right now are aimed at the New Deal and not just at the Great Society. Indeed, Glenn Beck's bete noire is Woodrow Wilson, and he thinks everything went haywire after Woodrow Wilson. So they're not just trying to trim at the edges. They are trying to roll back the entire progressive achievement, and you're seeing that in the courts. And I think Citizens United is a decision that is it just fits so perfectly with the conservative Supreme Courts in the Gilded Age. And indeed, the notion that corporations are people came out of those Gilded Age Supreme Courts. And I just have to share with your listeners the best line on that, which I recently heard is from Stephen Colbert, which is, yes, I want my daughter to grow up and marry a nice corporation.
I mean, you have a great section there about the Supreme Court, the Bush v. Gore, and then Citizens United decisions. And it's interesting, Justice John Paul Stevens' dissent in both those cases. Those dissents were so telling, and Stevens recently came out publicly saying that Citizens United is going to be overturned at some point because it's so inconsistent. But, boy, I don't think we have a chance for democracy, real democracy in this country, if we don't get that decision overturned, either with a new decision by the Supreme Court or amending the Constitution once and for all on that. What do you think on that?
I think there are some ways around it, but it's got to be overturned in one way or another. A couple of things on that. One of the striking things about Stevens' dissent is that he was clearly much more in tune with what the founders believed than Scalia was. He was, if you want to talk about originalism, Stevens is a guy who turned to scholarship by people like Zephyr Teachout and others. And what he showed is the founders were obsessed with corruption. They worried enormously about the corruption of government. They were obsessed with the impact of luxury on government. And Citizens United couldn't have been more antithetical to the original intentions of the founders. Garrett Epps, a great legal historian, once said that Justice Scalia's originalism is, I knew the founders were friends of mine, I know how they think. And I think that just if you want a war about originalism, I think Stevens wins that fight hands down over Scalia in the Citizens United case. I think there are some things we can do short term and some things we need to long term. Short term, The Federal Election Commission, the IRS, could actually put some controls on this, the fake charitable status of some of these political groups, forcing disclosure where there is no disclosure. It's not just that it's money from a lot of rich people. It's a lot of it's secret. And it seems to me that it is something voters have a right to know, who is trying to elect the person they are about to vote for or against. Senator Schumer, Congressman Van Hollen had a series of ways in which you could hem in Citizens United, let shareholders have a say when corporations give money, limitations on what foreign-owned companies could do. There are ways of hemming it in. I also think we need a public financing system geared toward matching small contributions, a 5-to-1 match, say, for all contributions under $200 and under, where what you want to try to do is create a large pool of small money to compete with the big money. But ultimately, we got to overturn Citizens United. Montana has a case coming up by the state of Montana says, wait a minute, we didn't want the railroads to control our state government then. We don't want big corporations to control our government now. I'd love to see if Justice Kennedy might have second thoughts. I'd like to pray that he takes a look at this and says, this isn't what I had in mind. But
well, I hope you're right.
I don't know if I might. That's a prayer, not a prediction.
I'm a gambler. I wouldn't bet on that one. We only have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to get your assessment of Obama. You write in the book that he was too willing to cling to bipartisanship long after it was obvious to a lot of people that the Republicans were in no frame of mind to come to any agreement with him.
Right. I think, you know, you saw this problem in two ways in particular. I think one is that he hung on to the hope of getting Republican support for the health care bill way past the time when he should have, and that delayed the health care bill in ways. It wasn't just President Obama. I think Senator Baucus still had hopes that his friend Chuck Grassley would go along with some reasonable health care bill. And that delay really, I think, is what has given the health care bill such a black eye in the public, because the process was so messy that the process got in the way of people's you know, tainted people's view of the whole bill. And also, I think progressives have done a lousy job of selling it. I still think it needs a defense. It's not a perfect bill by any means. You know, there are no perfect bills. To me, it was a very important step in the right direction toward covering a lot more Americans. And then you saw it in the debt ceiling fight. And what the Obama folks will say in their own defense is, look, we really believe they were going to take the country off the cliff. And we felt we couldn't take the risk with that. I get that. But it really made the president look weak at the end of the summer of the middle of the summer of 2011. I think he's shifted his rhetoric substantially since then. And I think he has picked a fight. You saw it recently in that speech he gave in Cleveland. He gave a great speech in Osawatomie, Kansas. And, you know, as somebody who was writing in the book a lot about the progressive tradition and Teddy Roosevelt, I told my friends that only the president of the Osawatomie Chamber of Commerce was happier about that speech than I was, because it was, a pretty full bore. It wasn't as radical, actually, as Teddy Roosevelt, but it was a pretty full bore defense of the progressive tradition. What's going to be curious is, if he is reelected, how he will govern. But what I found as I was writing the book is that the president's rhetoric was starting to get closer to where I was as the writing went on, because I thought he made some real mistakes early on, especially on the debt ceiling fight and health care. Now, at least rhetorically, I think he's in the right place.
But that's the question, whether it's campaign rhetoric or whether it'll actually translate into policy. One concern I have is still his flirtation with his grand bargain on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid with John Boehner. I mean, he keeps bringing it up, or the White House staff keeps bringing it up, and to my mind, that would be going backwards as far as using government as a liberating force.
As Bill Clinton might say, it depends on what the meaning of the words grand bargain is. That there is a notion that there are ways you could reform Medicare to get the costs down that would not hurt seniors, that would be aimed at sort of figuring out how to deliver healthcare more efficiently. And you could balance those with tax increases. There are other ways, Paul Ryan's budget at the extreme end, which is really designed over the long term to undercut the basic promise of universal coverage under Medicare. So I think progressives ultimately probably would be willing to make some deals to achieve fiscal solvency if a significant amount of revenue were put on the table. But I think, as I agree with your premise that undercutting these two core social programs is not something a progressive should want to do or the president should do.
Yeah, it could be like Clinton and welfare reform, where it just has destructive consequences down the road. You're a political predictor, let's put it that way. How do you see the election turning out?
If I had to bet right now, I'd still put money on Obama, but the odds I would put are shorter than they were a few months ago. And it's really for the obvious reasons. One is at the beginning of the year, the economy looked like it was on a better track. Those 200,000 jobs a month were looking pretty good. And then, bang, we have this poor jobs report. It's a shame that I think that the president didn't push for a bigger stimulus in the first place and push for more as we went along. It's particularly aid to state and local governments, where we would have about, as Paul Krugman never tires of pointing out, we'd probably have a point lower unemployment rate if states had sort of been held harmless. But I still think the president wins if something much worse doesn't happen with the economy. But oddly, Angela Merkel may play as much of a role in our election as Barack Obama or Mitt Romney.
And we'll have to wait and see. But we're out of time. E.J. Dionne's been my guest today. His latest book, Our Divided Political Heart. Thanks so much for being my guest
really,
today.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Pleasure is mine.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.